Hello, and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Today's episode might be one of my favorite episodes I've ever recorded. Today, I talk with Melissa Denizard, otherwise known mononymously as Melly, a cultural worker, activist, thought leader, and burgeoning pop star currently based in Bed-Stuy. I chat with Melly about a plethora of subjects like being a working activist since the age of 14, cleansing herself from social media, and how she's personally coping with the end of the world. All on top of working in the music industry, one of the toughest businesses to make it through unscathed. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode. So, for starters, like, I'm excited that you're here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I truly don't feel worthy.
Oh my God.
But what you do is really, when you reached out to me, I was really flattered that someone like you would even want to associate with little old me. Because, like, you're, for starters, like, I don't even know, like, how do I even start with, like, your portfolio alone? It's just, like, you're an award-winning activist, you're a cultural worker, a local organizer, a public speaker, a political educator, and also a burgeoning pop star.
That's a lot.
At just 20-something, like, I feel like you've achieved more in your life's work than most influential people do in a lifetime.
Well, damn, that's an intro.
But would you like to first start, just to start out, tell me and my listeners about who you are, the work you do, and what, just start small, like, for starters, what is your name?
Okay. So my name is Melly, and I'm just really excited to be here. Izzy, I remember when I did reach out to you, I was in a really tough place, and so I was just doing research. I was just going into the rabbit hole, and I found your YouTube channel, and I loved it, because video essays are an art, and I think you really mastered it, and as I was doing more research into the punk scene and into Riot Girl, I found your page, and I just reached out to you, and I was really surprised and happy that you answered, because that was literally a cold email. So I appreciate that. But my name is Melly, and I am all of those things that Izzy just mentioned. But most of all, I'm just a girl, like, and I just vibe for a living. Like, that's what I do, and I've had really the honor of my life just spiraling into different places that I never thought it would. But really, I'm just a dreamer, and I think about things, I manifest them into real life, and yeah, that's me.
And also, speaking of just manifesting things into real life, I feel like a lot of the work that you do is very inspiring, because it comes out of personal and political turmoil in the current end times, mm-hmm. that we're terrifyingly living through at the moment. And I guess my next question is a bit of a heavy one, but how are you personally coping with the end of the world?
Oh my God, moment? I love that question. How am I coping with the end of the world? I'm building a new one. And I think even better, I'm building my own. And what's really beautiful about that is I get to invite other people into it. And it's big enough where it can hold other worlds and other experiences and other perspectives. And I think when people interact with that, or they come into my energy field, I think that really leaves a lasting impression, because we don't live in a world today that tells you that your world is even worthy of being experienced. And so that's how I'm coping with the end of the world. I'm building a new one feverishly, but also at my own pace.
And that's very important to do, yeah. To do it at your own pace, especially when you're grappling with also, in addition to creating a new world, also having to deal with the world you're living in that doesn't necessarily want to be changed, mm-hmm. in a way.
Yeah.
So what I also think is really cool about what you're doing, in addition to the creative work and the proactive way that you're engaging with things like mutual aid, restoring funding for the arts into education, especially for young people, is that you're really proactively engaging, like, on a ground level, mm-hmm. with a variety of people and actually experiencing the people face to face, because that is not easy to do these days.
Not at all.
You can read as many books as possible, but that's not something you're going to learn unless, yeah. you're really engaging with those people face to face. So would you like to tell me a little bit about how being like a creative and interweaving art with activism?
So I'm really glad you kicked this off with that question, because this is something that I'm also starting to understand and recognize the value of. Because when I first started my music career, I was very specific. You know, I said, you know, I want to be the person that glamorizes the culture worker, that makes this work exciting and alluring and sexy. And I think from the very jump, I was doing something completely different from the status quo. But I didn't understand that for real. It's like I knew that, but I didn't understand it because I hadn't lived through it yet. There's like exactly what you said. There's a difference between even saying something and then actually going through the motions of what it really means to be a cultural worker or an activist, someone who came up in that world and is now going into the music industry, which is hell on wheels.
A foul and dirty, despicable place.
Oh my God. And you gotta understand, like, being a teen activist, I was very wide-eyed and naive. And again, it's not to say that I was hidden away from the horror of the world, because that's exactly what I was doing. Like, I was literally like protesting and advocating for a better world for Black people. Like, so I have to be familiar with how bad it can get in order for me to advocate for something better. But I don't know, like, I was just that kid. I just really thought I was gonna change the world. Like, no matter how ugly things were, I was just always like, it doesn't matter. Like, I know this can be better. I know I can create something new. So coming into the music industry and just really looking around and not really understanding what I was getting into, I didn't understand how radical it would be to actually meet people on the ground and do this type of work. Because the music industry, it communicates utmost perfection at all time, which is really hard because in the back end, behind the scenes, it's a shit show all the time, every day. And there's no break from it. So it's interesting because that the behind the scenes in the music industry also mirrors the real world in the sense of it's a shit show. It's dirty. It's fucked up. There's a lot of things going on all the time. And so meeting people where they're at and really, really, really perceiving everyone as valuable, even without a title or without a certain identity marker or whatever the case is, it's been risky. It's been tough because I also am placed in a space now where I have to advocate on behalf of others. And being a pop star, the show is really supposed to run around you. And what really tends to happen is I'm in the middle, but I'm trying to veer away from the spotlight because I'm trying to give other people the spotlight. And that makes for a really dangerous cocktail of sorts. But it's honestly, it's been the most rewarding work I've ever done. And it's been the most fun I've ever had in my life. And I'm learning a lot. about where we are as a society, as a culture. And it's not good. It's not looking good. But I guess now the question is, like, what do I do with that information? And what do I do about it if I do anything about it? So, yeah.
Right, right. And let's get into Dirty Girl.
Okay.
So what is it? What does it do? What is the vision and the mission behind it? And how does it subvert the typical lens of the personal and the political, which through a pedagogical like lens or whatever can not always be that exciting or sexy, as you said earlier.
Yeah. So Dirty Girl is my dream come true. It is everything I wanted and needed as a young girl, especially as a young person that was thrust into movement work. I think Dirty Girl, in a lot of ways, it's my personal manifesto. It's saying, this is the world we live in. It's a dirty world that is characterized by systems of oppression and systems of domination. And I can't sit on my high horse. I am a part of that world. And so because I'm a part of this world, I am also a dirty girl. And meaning that these systems of domination exist within me, and it's my personal responsibility to rid myself of those systems, of those ways of thinking, in order to create the freedom that I'm looking for and I'm seeking. And when I say freedom, I'm not just talking about what people tell you freedom is, or, you know, the government tells you freedom is, because we talk about these rights that we have and that's what makes us free. But really, freedom is what exists in your head first. Freedom is you knowing what exists outside of you and saying, I'm gonna find peace within myself. And so that's what Dirty Girl is. Dirty Girl is really, it really began with me seeking that freedom within myself, and then realizing that when I'm free, when I'm my best self, when I'm my most inhibited, other people can get free too. And so yeah, I think Dirty Girl is really, it's really a reflection of me and all my experiences that I've been through. And it's growing into something even bigger, something that I think that's existing outside of me. But it wouldn't be what it is without me. And so as much as I'm like excited to see other people in embracing this ideology and this identity, I also know that it's just as a part of me as I am a part of it.
So while we're on like the topic of how you can't necessarily separate the movement from the individual, do you want to give me some of your favorite examples, I guess, of be it real world or fictional leaders who exemplify that type of like ethos?
I think a very common historical example is Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. Because what's interesting about him as a figure is he is exemplary of that time. Like, you don't think about the 1950s and 1960s without thinking about MLK. And at the same time, it's interesting. I recently taught a workshop at Mount Holyoke, and I was looking at the videos, and I had said something about Martin Luther King. I had recited a quote from him, which is, power without love is reckless and abusive, but love without power is anemic. And as I'm watching the video, I heard people laughing the moment I brought him up. And it's interesting because he's the perfect example of, you can't separate the movement from the individual, because I don't want to just say the right. I think all political parties in the United States have really kind of made a mockery of his legacy in terms of his radical legacy and what he really advocated for, which was the eradication of capitalism in order to have this anti-black world. And they've really done a good job of mocking his legacy. And so it's gotten to the point now where if you do say his name, some people might laugh. And they might look back at that time in history, not really understanding how radical it really was for Black people to not take the bus, right? To host a boycott, to march on Washington, to do these really, what to us may seem like really small things, what it really meant to put your body on the line at that time. So I think that's a perfect historical example. But I think even recently with Black Lives Matter, the Black Lives Matter movement, that movement began with three Black women. And I want to make sure I remember all their names, Opal Temeti, Patrice Cullors, and I'm forgetting the last person's name, Alicia Garza. And they were three Black women who started this movement because they were going to meetings. And I remember I read this one book where I think Alicia Garza said she was spit on for advocating for Black women's contributions to this movement, queer contributions to this movement, and our right to have respect and to also be a part of the manifesto of the things that we're fighting for. And what began as this Black feminist movement and rioting cry, it really soon became what every other Black movement has been in this country, which is a focusing on cis hetero patriarchal values, right? And the reason why is because the movement became bigger than those individuals. And I think there's definitely, even those two examples I just gave you, Martin Luther King and those three Black women, there's a reason why Martin Luther King is the face of the civil rights movement. And I couldn't even remember all three of their names. Because being a Black woman and being a Black man, there's a concerted effort to make sure that you are rendered invisible. And it happens to both of us, but at different rates and at different times. And I think, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement, there was a lot of radical potential with that movement. And I think it would have looked different now if it had been started by three Black men instead of three Black women. So to answer your question, yeah.
For sure. Those are two really good examples. And I think another really disheartening fact about the sort of watering down mm-hmm. of the MLK legacy is that he tends to be the name most invoked by white people mm-hmm. In very poisonous optics mm-hmm. where it's just like, well, I can use this historic mm-hmm. leader as like the face of my straw man argument mm-hmm. to put down a person who is actually a person of color experiencing mm-hmm. oppression, who might make my personal experiences uncomfortable and make me question mm-hmm. everything. You know what I'm saying?
I know, like, exactly yeah. what you're saying. And you know what's interesting too, Izzy, is we often think that it's only like liberal white people who do that, but the right also has a strategy that is so diabolically genius. But essentially what they've done is the right, what they do is they invoke imagery of, let's say, Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement and things of that nature. They invoke these radical images to also inspire their own constituents. So they're like, okay, like, let me pervert Martin Luther King's dream and legacy and perspectives to push forward my own anti-Black sentiments and my own anti-Black perspectives and goals. And it's just so interesting how, especially being a Black radical in this country, you often don't even have control over your narrative. Once you put it out there, it's no longer yours. And I think that what that does to our movements is it creates a very, how do I say, a very disorganized landscape from the jump. So yeah, I think it's just interesting. And the more we talk about this, it's just making me think about some of my own struggles that I've had developing Dirty Girl and why that might be. Because I think for utmost, like, I'm really just figuring it out as I go. There is no, like, blueprint for this. This is, you just live it and you reflect as you go.
Absolutely. And how would you say that your relationship to music weaves into that on a personal and political level? Because it's a really odd paradox, trying to navigate a capitalist society as an artist and a radical, and also too often always having that sort of lingering idea that can there ever be an artistic utopia, I guess, if music continues to be commodified, or is that obsolete? Oh God, we're getting like really into it now. So how would you say that your relationship to music ties into everything?
I've always been a musician, but really a singer. Ever since I was a kid, I used to like just walk down the street and sing as loud as I could, not even thinking about what was happening outside of me. But it was so interesting because I was also really shy. And so I didn't want anybody to know that I could sing, because I always in the back of my mind just didn't think I was good enough. But even that question of are you good enough is tied to capitalism, because and how we have commodified music as this thing that is consumable and is sellable. So we grow up thinking there is a good way of being a musician and there is a bad way of being a musician. And so often the good examples are the pop examples, you know, the musicians that are hyper sellable and hyper consumable. And I think that limitation that I placed on myself, that question of are you good enough, it really slowed me down. And it didn't help that then I started doing musical theater, because that's a whole nother ball game that requires hyper perfection all the time. And I think too, in my personal history, I went to a school district where music was underfunded. You know, from K through 12, I really saw the degradation of our right to a quality education as Black and Brown youth. And so from a very young age too, it became very clear that music, or the access to a music education, is a rarity, and it's becoming even more rare in this country. And I think overall, like, I've always been an artist, but I've also always had to grapple with the externality of it all. Like, are you good enough? Can you make the audience clap? Can you advocate for your right to a better education? Can you get the governor to give you $3 million to restore arts and music? And I just don't think it's been something I could escape. But I think now, as I'm getting older, and I'm really having an opportunity to explore myself and understand who I am good enough. I'm more than good enough. I'm lit. Like, and I think the more that you really allow yourself to just explore your artistry, and not necessarily like what you're able to produce, but more so the more you're able to appreciate the artist, like the person that is actually producing the art, you start to understand it doesn't really matter what anybody else says your value is. As long as you know I am valuable, I am good enough, they're gonna find out soon enough. Like, that's period. And so now I don't really focus on the selling of it or even the producing of it. I just focus more on being. And I think the more that we allow ourselves to have fun and to be in the society, the more that we'll have an opportunity to come into that understanding for ourselves. But I understand it's hard when you're working a 9-to-5 and you're commuting to work and you have all these burdens and responsibilities. There's a reason why our society is set up in this way, where you don't have as much free time, because if you did, you would probably know yourself. You would probably understand the artist you are.
Yeah. And if we could play, if we play a game and we point to five of the nearest local musicians, mm-hmm. I guarantee you the first one we point to is Tending Bar 60 hours a week right now.
Yeah.
It really does keep us, like, sedated and overworked mm-hmm. to a point where we don't even have time to question everything.
Yeah.
And keeps the cycle repeating itself.
Yeah. And honestly, like, it's really special where I am now in my life, because I quit my job when? I quit my job in March. No, in February. And I was blessed with the opportunity to just vibe for a few months. Like, I haven't had to worry about paying rent for, like, since March. And at first I felt like, you know, really, how do I say? I felt like I wasn't doing the right thing. Like, I felt like I need to be working, or I need to get a job, or I need to do this, or I need to do that. But I'm really learning to appreciate, not even learning, I have learned to appreciate where I am now, because this is really, like, the utmost of privileges. Like, because I get to just have fun and think and explore myself and really be a child again. And I mean, I started working when I was 16, you know, and like, those are years I can't get back. But now it's like I have the wisdom and the insight of a 24-year-old who's been through so much to just appreciate rest and appreciate play and fun. So it's the utmost privilege, and I don't think many of us will get to experience that again in this lifetime. The pandemic is gone. No more staying at home. But I'm grateful that I have this time, and I'm grateful that I have the wisdom to appreciate it for what it is.
Yeah, that's a very wise take and just mindset for sure. And I remember, like, when we were speaking the last time we hung out, mm-hmm. you asked me where do you see yourself going in the future and yada, yada, yada. And I remember thinking, like, that's a good question, you know. I think, I don't know, like, there's a lot of, like, contamination, like, when it comes to, like, direction and ambition and, like, what does that even mean, like, under capitalism, you know? And I asked you, and you were like, hi, Keen. I think I'm already there. Like, and
the high key part is accurate.
And I think that is so important to come to that place, just as an individual, knowing that you're not necessarily, even if you don't necessarily have everything together, or you aren't always, or you don't have all the answers, you know? Just having that affirmation that you are good enough and you do know yourself and you do know where you want to be. We have to stop perpetuating the myth that that's an ego thing, you know? Yeah.
You know what it is? And I'm so glad you remember that, because sometimes, Izzy, I just start talking. Like, I just feel like God kind of tells me what to say, and I don't always remember what I said. I think what it is really is, I just know that I've worked hard enough. I've done as much as I could. Like, you gotta understand, I've been working as an activist since I was 14 years old. Like, there's not much more I wanna do now. Like, and I think that's also, I wanna say honestly, a power move to just be like, okay, I don't have to work hard anymore. Like yes, there are certain things I wanna work hard for and I wanna labor for, but in terms of, like, having to prove myself anymore, what am I proving myself for? And who am I proving myself to? Like, I just feel like there's definitely a, like, you're allowed to wake up and say, I've given my all, and I've done things that I never thought I would be able to do, and now I can calm down a little bit. Like, I can rest. But and at the same time, I also recognize that this is a very unique position to be in. Like, being 24 and being able to say that and being able to look at my history and say, okay, like, you've done all that you needed to do. I know a lot of 24-year-olds can't say that. And also, I think that we place a lot of pressure on ourselves to have a purpose or to do this really, like, big thing. I remember earlier this year, I was in Puerto Rico. I was in Aguadilla. And I had taken a trip to the beach. I walked all the way there because there's no Uber on that side of the island. And I just was laying on this patch of grass. It was this beautiful, serene, secluded beach. And I'm looking at the clouds. It's this beautiful day. And I just thought to myself, this is all humans ever have to do, Izzy. This is all we have to do. It's just appreciate the earth and what has just been given to us. And yet we decided we had to do more. We had to go to war. We had to create all these new technologies. And at the ground level, all you have to do as a human being is just appreciate what's in front of you. And I think for me, I'm just learning. I've just learned to appreciate my life. I'm very content. And life is so beautiful. And the act of living is so, I would say, radical. Especially now, because if you look around you, no one's really living. Like, and if they are living, it's all for the purpose of either making money or turning their life into content or whatever the case is. And all you have to do is just vibe. That's all you have to do. And so, yeah, like, that's where I am now. And I don't remember what the question was, but I just want you to know, all you have to do is vibe. And the rest will come. But I think right now, I am exactly where I want to be, because life is really an adventure. And everything that I've done, everything on my resume, I never sat down and said, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be 16 years old getting $3 million from the state. I'm not going to be in college going to Flint, Michigan and doing this. Like, yes, I had those ideas. But I never thought they would turn into what they turned into. It was kind of like, just let go and let God. Because there's a difference between a plan and a strategy. You can have a plan, but it's not going to turn out how you thought it was going to turn out. And I think my strategy has always been to just let go and do what I want to do in that moment and trust that it's going to turn into what it needs to turn into. So, yeah.
Well, that begs the question for me, what do you feel ultimately got you to that place? Mm-hmm. Because I feel like, I mean, you've been working since you were like 14 to 16, like that, like you said. And so there must have come a time where you were just like, that's it. I've had enough. I just want to quit, like, you know, and which is like it's too easy to come to that place all the time for most of us, and like, especially when we feel like we're barely even living anymore. Which, I mean, like, what does living even mean, like, in this climate and in this time and place where the world is like quite literally ending right before our eyes, a slow, painful death. But anyway, enough about the apocalypse. But on that track, like, when you do come to those points where you want to quit, what brings you back to that place and sort of like back to earth where you're like, no, what I'm doing is enough. I'm just vibing and I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, you know?
So it's so funny. Whenever I start to like experience anxiety in front of other people, they always say like, I didn't think you had I didn't think you had the capacity to be this way. They're always surprised to see me be human. And I'm just like, yeah, I do get anxious. And yeah, I do have moments of doubt. Yeah. And the truth of the matter is, I probably have one of those moments like at least once a week. Because the work that I'm doing and the life that I'm living, it is oftentimes in complete opposition to what is the norm. And so every single day I am faced with the question of, are you good enough? And not only are you good enough, but are you normal? And, like, why can't you just be like everybody else? Like, why can't you just, like, calm down and mind your business and keep your head down? And I think the answer to that question is something I always say to myself, which is when you really sit back and you start to study the happenings of your life, like, just really take a step back and really understand, like, just the different moments in your life that have happened to you or have happened around you, you'll start to see God. And what I mean by that is I don't mean this big man in the sky. I mean, like, you're going to start to see your highest self. You're going to start to see that moment when you just push past all your anxiety, all your fear, and you still did the thing. And it came out beautifully. And it became something you never thought it would have became. I think what pushes me through those moments is accessing my highest self, knowing that there is no greater power than what is inside of me right now. And it's not to say that I won't have moments of fear and I won't have moments of doubt and anxiety, but it's to know that I've pushed through those moments before so I can push through them again. And each time that I do so, it's going to teach me something, and it's going to allow me to access something far greater than I probably would have ever imagined. Like, I spend days where, like, I'll just be thinking about certain things, and it'll you ever have, like, those thoughts where, like, you don't know where the end is, where the end of the tunnel is, and you're just deep in the weeds? And then when I finally get out of it, I'm like, oh my God, like, thank you. Because I never could have imagined to have this realization or to have this epiphany, but I did. And so apply that thinking to the toughest moments in your life. You may not see the end of the tunnel or the light at the end of the tunnel, but, like, it's coming. And you just have to trust your highest self. You have to trust that God is persevering and you're going to get to that other side. Because once you give up, nothing else really matters. Everything ends when you give up. Doesn't matter what anybody outside tells you, but once you decide that you can't do it, that you can't go farther, it's over. It's game over. So if you want the game to keep going, you have to keep pushing forward.
Wow. I love that. We're getting spiritual up in here. Like, I feel like I'm, like, ascending to another plane of existence as I'm listening to you. But you know what? On the track of, like, while we're, like, having God talk right now, something that's so interesting that I've observed as someone who has immersed themselves in the arts their whole life, like, I was trained in classical ballet growing up, like, and I've listened to music my whole life. My parents were, like, very voracious music heads, and just, like, observing the cult of celebrity and everything from a distance. And I was talking to a coworker of mine who I also had as a guest on the podcast before, and something she said to me was that, you know, when you think of, like, a boy band or people who go see these larger than life idols, like, I guess a modern day example would be a Harry Styles, but, like, when you think of, like, Beatlemania, or you think of, like, Elvis, or, like,
Big Time historic, Rush.
Big Time Rush. Oh my God. Have you been, like, paying attention to, like, oh, this Big Time Rush reunion? I'm low-key, like, I have not been, like, tuned into that, but, like, I was a big Time Rush head as a kid.
Yes, I love Kendall. That's his name, right?
The blonde. Yeah, yes. Yeah. But when you think about it, like, these larger-than-life figures on stage that brings all these teenage girls, like, out to these settings, and they're, like, screaming their heads off and connecting with their most primal, like, selves. Like, that, there's nothing like that, and it is, like, connecting to a higher power. Yeah. And something that my coworker told me was that there's nothing like it, but actually there is. The only things that are like it are sports and religion. And what I think is so fascinating about the cult of celebrity and why we're so attached to these figures that we don't know personally is that for a lot of people, especially if you're thinking about it through a secular lens, they're the closest things that we have to a god, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's dark because if you really think about it too, religion and people going to church has been on the decline for decades. And it's really, I think to a certain case, I would argue it's disempowering for people to not have that relationship to a higher power. But I would say that even the design and the format of religion in the past has been disempowering, because what would often happen is, one, mind you, churches are a really great organizing place. One of the ways that the right is able to organize so well is they go into these small towns where people still go to church, where people still have that communing time on Sunday. And churches are often the best place to give information, to get people to vote for, you know, an upcoming mayor, or to even go to the city budget meeting. So churches are a really great place for that. But often what you would have is people going to church and they would be relying on the pastor to interpret the text for them. Remember, like, during slavery, there were slaves that didn't know how to read, so they were relying on other people to interpret the text for them, giving that power away to somebody else. But I think what this new generation is going to require, or maybe what actually might be most empowering right now, is to really trust in your own interpretation, your own understanding of spirituality and your own relationship to God. God is really like whatever you say it is. And I think the more you tap into that, the more you tap into your ability to create whatever it is you want to create, I think that's going to be the most empowering thing, especially now when nothing is really what it seems. Like you mentioned AI, like everything is so, everything feels like a lie sometimes.
Literally,
you know? Yeah,
everything.
Yeah. And so if everything feels like a lie, if everything feels like it's made up, then why don't you make up your own thing too?
Period.
What's the worst that could happen?
Also, like you mentioned how easy it is to manipulate people, like you mentioned the period of like illiteracy and during slavery and all that, and what's also really dark to think about now is like the illiteracy rate in the U.S. is like 54%. Like, I think that's an estimate that I'm like recalling like deep in the recesses of my memory. So it could be inaccurate, but it's a scary rate. Like, scary. The rate of people who don't read. And I feel like the internet has like exacerbated that so much, with people who are just screaming their heads off in arguments about things they know nothing about, you know?
Which is, it's the ultimate paradox, because we have more access to information than we ever have. And yet, I think we're still giving the power away to interpreters. You know, like, I remember I was on TikTok and somebody got really upset with me. But I saw this video and it was just like, what did it say? It was saying how the U.S. wants to ban TikTok because we have way too much access to information. They're afraid of what we're going to do with it. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't think that's what the government's doing. Like, I think we've had access to this information for quite some time. Like, even being on YouTube. YouTube has so much. Like, I love YouTube. Like, I just want to say that, because there's so much on there. And if you really just, like, use your own power of interpretation, like, really just fall in love with the act of learning, like, you can create anything you want, because it's really, like, your interpretation. You're not relying on anybody else. But I think with all this consuming of content, all this consuming of internet personalities, we're giving away that power of free thought. What does it mean to actually look at pieces of information and create your own opinion from it? I don't think many of us know how to do that. And even when we think we're doing it, we're just regurgitating what we heard from somebody else. So it is a scary time. And I don't really know what to do about it. But I think it's really something that you can model. I don't think it's something that you can tell somebody to do. Somebody has to want that information in order to do something with it.
That is very true, yeah. And, well, to cap off our conversation, we touched on a lot. I wanted to ask you, what are some of your top five, maybe top three in ballpark albums of all time?
That's a hard question.
It's always a hard question. No one likes getting asked it, but I just can't resist the urge to ask.
To be honest, I actually am a person. I'm the type of person that will listen to a complete body of work rather than like a single. But I'm really bad with names. So I would want to say one of my favorite albums of all time is definitely, it's definitely has to be like a Jill Scott. One of her earlier works though, I just don't remember the name. It has a blue cover, I think. But I think Jill Scott's earlier work specifically, it was just put together really well and her storytelling is really beautiful and full. So I really enjoyed her work. And I've listened to recently that I really enjoy is The Age of Pleasure by Janelle Monáe. That's a really beautiful body of work. And at first I didn't think I would like it, but then I couldn't stop singing it. And I think she has like some really beautiful intentions. So I really enjoyed that. And then the third one absolutely would have to be a Beyonce. And I would say it's four by Beyonce, because that really represented her really betting on herself. And it for me, it's the perfect transition into who she has become. So it's definitely four, because without four, we wouldn't have Beyonce and we wouldn't have Renaissance and we wouldn't have all the other bodies of work that she's created since then. So those are my top three.
Nice. Those are great choices. I love Beyonce's approach to sampling that mm-hmm. she took with Renaissance. Mm-hmm. There's so many Easter eggs
yeah.
in there.
Yeah.
A lot of Easter eggs. Yeah. And if you're a music geek, like, that is just stuff that will make a music historian and or music writer just wet. Just like
that's funny.
But I am also obsessed with albums and just like the whole idea of an experience within an album. Mm-hmm. Like, I really like, I think concept albums can often be turn out very cheesy if mm-hmm. not done right. One of the most interesting examples to me is Downward Spiral by Nine Inch Nails, which is a linear, very clear narrative of a man descending slowly into madness.
Interesting.
And the really clear and innovative approach to industrial rock production that Trent Reznor just perfected in, and also made it hooky mm-hmm. and catchy. Like, industrial music had been just heading into that direction, and he like took it where it needed to go. And on top of it, you have this whole like immersive story woven throughout the whole project. That's one of my favorite like perfect albums mm-hmm. that I'm obsessed with. I love, and I think concept albums are very lofty, like I said earlier. There's a lot of expectation there, but I think that's a really good example of an experience that I love. When you get to hear a story mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you get to fully immerse yourself in that world.
You know, the last, if I could sneak in a fourth, I would say Miley Cyrus's Breakout is such a good, it has all the good things for me. I think it wasn't a concept album like you said, but I think it was telling a story in the sense of like she was really coming out, and I think she's one of those like child prodigies that we just don't appreciate as much as we should. But that's one of my favorites. The inner child in me really goes wild.
Yes. Speaking of inner child, that's something that's another major factor in like your praxis, mm-hmm. as it were. Just reconnecting with that sense of self where you feel like you are most yourself, yeah. which is when you're, there's studies that show like that you're most connected to your true self mm-hmm. when you were arguably like 5 to 6 years old.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I've really learned the most from my inner child these past few years. I think when I'm lost and I don't know what to do, I find myself doing the things that I thought I would do when I was a kid. And I was a very prolific kid. Like, I remember writing in my diary exactly what I thought I would be doing as an older woman. And anytime I feel like I'm going off steer, if I really sit back and reflect and think about it, this is exactly who I thought I would be. And it's really beautiful to be in conversation with my younger self in that way, because I don't think she's gone. I think she's inside of me, and I think she has a lot to teach me just as much as my highest self has a lot to teach me. And so I think it's really coming to understand yourself as a living archive. There's so much inside of you that just needs to be rummaged through, and it's never ending. That's the beautiful thing about it. Even when you think you've gotten to the bottom, another bottom opens. So yeah, inner child, it's not even about the healing part. I know that's what we often associate it with, but as much as there was a lot of heartbreak in my childhood, there was also a lot of joy and a lot of freedom of expression that I'm very grateful for. So yeah, I lean on her for a lot. Yeah,
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, if there's anything we can glean from this conversation, it is love thy inner child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And love thyself.
And love thyself, yeah, above all else. Well, Melly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For engaging and conversing with me throughout all of my neurotic ramblings. And I appreciated getting theoretical and political and just vibing.
Yes, I always appreciate the vibe. Thank you so much, Izzy. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy, and thank you again to Melissa Denizard, aka Melly, for joining me today. Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy.